This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action New York's Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Revolution. Joining us today is John O'Connor, MD. He's probably the most exciting MD that I have ever had the opportunity to interview and speak with. I know so much about him, and he's done these very, very strong and necessary and intelligent things, these actions he's taken, where he conducts his medical practice in the parts of the province of Alberta which are being impacted by pollutants released by the tar sands mining and exploitation. Good afternoon, Dr. O'Connor.
Hi, Don. How are you doing?
Yep. Thank you so much for giving us of your time. You know, I'm beginning to understand that you are a very, very busy person with all the people you care for, and I'm sure that has been made much busier by the harm to the health of these people that has been occurring over the past several decades as the tar sands activity has intensified. Let's just start off. Tell me something about yourself. You know, just tell us, you know, about you. People like to know some things about a person that makes them a real individual, specific, unique person. For us, you know, how did you come to be, you know, an MD that's working in northern Alberta, you know, this time?
I'll give you the slightly shorter version of the story.
Okay.
I'm a 53-year-old Irish graduate, graduated in Galway in the west coast of Ireland, came to Canada for 6 months in 1984. My plan was to spend at least 2 years after that in a place called Stornoway in the Outer Hebrides off the coast of Scotland, an amazing place. Coming to Nova Scotia in 84 was just sort of a stopgap, experience the other side of the pond sort of thing. And, you know, through sort of falling in love with the area, I was persuaded to stay. Spent from 84 to 93 in a practice on the south shore of Nova Scotia, an amazing place. And then for family reasons, decided that tried to make a foothold in Alberta. At the time, Canada was making it difficult for portability of your medical degree unless you were a graduate of a Canadian or North American medical school. So came out to Fort McMurray in 1993, and set up practice and quickly became very busy. A few months after arriving in town, I had my first exposure to First Nations or Aboriginal peoples. Now in Ireland, the greatest likelihood of coming across somebody of that kind of background would be watching John Wayne on TV. You know, we don't have any population of Aboriginal North American First Nations peoples there, having experienced dealing with them in my practice, I was fascinated by just their whole approach to life and culture and medicine and philosophy. We can learn so much from what they do. They're in many ways way more advanced than we are. So I started providing service to one of three First Nations communities outside of Port McMurray in 1994, a place called Jeanvier, a very poor community, small population, and sort of under-doctored for many, many years. That was followed by visiting the First Nation just north of Fort McMurray called Fort Mackay. That was about 4 years later, so I was providing service to both of those as well as doing my general sort of family practice in Fort McMurray. And then in 2000 started going up to Fort Chipewyan is the largest of the three First Nations surrounding Fort McMurray. It's situated downstream of the tar sands on the northern shore of Lake Athabasca. So it's about an hour's flight north of Fort McMurray. What's that?
You fly.
Yeah, actually, it's a winter road, an ice road, open 2 months of the year, but 10 mm-hmm. months of the year, it's a flight or by boat, and boat takes quite a while. So,
yeah
flew up there on a weekly basis, and And again, I was also visiting the other First Nations at the same time in the other parts of my week. I got to realize quite soon after arriving in Fort Chip that the community, for its location, seemed to be carrying a fairly large burden of illness. Now, Fort Chip, if you look at it on a map, is way off the beaten track. It's actually situated on the edge of the Canadian Shield, an absolutely pristine location. And one of the peculiar things about it back then was the cost of living up there was horrendous in terms of just feeding oneself. So as a result of that, and probably just as a result of tradition anyway, about 80% of the community subsisted, and I believe still does, on traditional food, so hunting, fishing, gathering, and trapping. So in its location, like I said, way off the beaten track, far away from the processed life that we enjoyed in a location south of Fort Chip, it seemed the ideal sort of way of life, and they had carried on this way of life for thousands of years. Fort Chip is the oldest settlement in Alberta. People can trace back their roots about 12,000 years to that very location. So things had not changed over the years in terms of their way of life. So finding a burden of illness in the community, a population of somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 people, a burden of illness as large as it was very surprising. So then, you know, it began to unfold before my eyes as to where this community was located and what potentially could be influencing health in the community. In other words, the industry upstream, the tar sands. And that's sort of where the story began over the last few years in terms of my involvement with I guess, media and the powers that be in both Alberta and in Canada.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about, you know, I've talked to other people who tell me about, you know, your courage and your resilience and your persistence in doing your, you know, caring for these people that need the health care, plus taking up this sword of dealing with the harm that's coming from tar sands activity. So let's just get, you know, really tight about the time frame. How long had the tar sands, you know, how long were pollutants going into the Athabasca River, you know, from tar sands activity? When did that start?
Well, the industry began very first, I believe it was 1967.
Okay.
On a small scale. And it has sort of more or less steadily increased in activity and size since then, with a few periods of sort of doldrums, so to speak. But basically, this is its 44th year, I think, yep.
That's a long time.
A long time.
And so the diseases that you were observing there, and this is in the 90s, that's, you know, after 40 years of being poisoned, you know, just gradually more and more. I'm sure, like, back in the 60s and 70s, there would not have probably been an apparent disease burden that was obviously something, like, unusual that you would have noticed. Seems that you came there at a really opportune time to see the effect of all that contamination that just gradually harmed those people over all those decades. Almost two generations, actually. So tell us about what diseases you encountered.
Well, just referring to what you said, Donald, we're not in a position, I'm not in a position to categorically state that the tar sands pollutants are the cause of the illnesses and cancers in Fort Chip. This is something that science, I guess, needs to focus more closely on. There hasn't been any sort of in-community study of issues specific to the pollutants that have been identified as emanating from the the tar sands and affecting the water and the air,
right,
and the traditional foods. So, you know, among the possibilities as to the origins of the health problems and the cancers specifically, the four possibilities are pure bad luck, lifestyle, genetics, or environmental influences. Now, we know that environmental influences are linked to the vast majority of cancers, period, no matter where you are.
Yep.
But we still haven't gotten the final piece, or maybe two pieces, of that linkage. But
I know what you're saying. There hasn't been an epidemiological study done there that carefully analyzed, you know, with statistics and with, you know, very careful gathering of, you know, what they call them there, like survey-type data and information from the public and body burden data. There hasn't been a study like that done.
No, and that sampling, specifically biological sampling, is something that's sort of on the card that needs to be done. And, in fact, we're kind of slowly moving in that direction now, thanks to the media coverage of the story. So, you know, to state that, you know, there is a direct link would be jumping ahead a little bit too quickly.
Yep. Right. I totally agree with you. So what diseases do you observe in the village of Fort Chipewyan?
Well, the biggest issue for me, and I guess for everyone who's looking at it, is the number of cases of biliary tract cancer. When I went up there at the outset, I was very impressed with the prior documentation in patients' files of the amount of cancer in the community and other illnesses such as autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, thyrotoxicosis, vitiligo, and you know, potentially a percentage of the diabetes in the community. And then renal failure, hypertension, heart disease, and sort of a plethora of other illnesses. But biliary tract cancer and colon cancer, lymphatic cancers, leukemia, brain cancer, sort of a bunch of neurological based cancers. But the biggest issue by far, the GI tract cancer numbers, and that was prior to me coming into the community. And then in the short few years leading up to the media getting hold of this, the number of cases that I myself had seen, which I shouldn't have, certainly in those numbers in such a small community. And in fact, on average, as a GP, one specific type of bile duct cancer called cholangiocarcinoma, I probably shouldn't have seen as a GP, or if I had, I'd probably just see one in my lifetime. And it just happened to be one that my father had passed away from in 1993 in Ireland, this cholangiocarcinoma, or Klatsen's tumor, as it's called. So, you know, the number.
So how many cases did you just see in Fort Chip?
Five documented. One thing that, you know, in the course of the early media interest in this, one mistake, one error that I made, and I've since corrected it, and very quickly afterwards, was that I had said that I had diagnosed these cases of cancer. And of course, one thing that family physicians do not do is diagnose cancer. They strongly, clinically suspect and make the appropriate referrals, and the testing that needs to be done afterwards happens. And then the specialist or the pathologist who's done the analysis of the tissue samples that have been removed, is the person that actually makes the diagnosis in the end.
Okay.
At least that's the way it happens in Canada.
Okay.
So my strong clinical suspicion of these cancer cases had, at the point when the media got hold of it, numbered five cases of bile duct cancer, including two cases of cholangiocarcinoma, which is much rarer than, you know, general bile duct cancer. Now, cholangiocarcinoma occurs at a rate of 1 in 100,000. And there were two documented cases. Authorities claimed there were three. I had two males that had died from the disease. The subsequent analysis by federal authorities here in Canada said there was a third female who I was not aware of. And that sort of case has fallen into obscurity. They no longer quote anything about that case. But so we're definitely got two cholangiocarcinoma cases and five in total of bile duct cancer, which is huge for that size of population.
Is there any scientific literature on causation for that kind of cancer?
Oh yeah, it can be linked directly with pollutants that emanate from the petroleum industry. There are other possibilities as well, such as radiation, and there's a very small potential or possible connection in a sort of genetic fashion, but these cases were not related at all. They were completely different families, so the experts that have looked at this have said, no, it's definitely not a genetic issue. There's no evidence of exposure to radiation in the community at all, and again, this is from federal authorities here in Canada. So we're looking at other possible etiologies.
Yeah, when you say this research basis, you know, this research foundation exists about exposure to pollutants from the oil industry.
Yes.
Can you be more specific? Are there any, you know, specific chemicals, chemical groups, names of chemicals, you know?
Well, I am told reliably that the potential exists for a connection with PAH exposure, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
Yep. Yeah, we've heard a lot about those down here on Long Island, and you know, it's part of New York State, southern New York City, and they had a Long Island breast cancer study done there a long time ago by the National Cancer Institute, and one of the only clear findings of that study was that PAH addicts on, you know, the DNA of these women that had breast cancer, they were more numerous. You know, the higher the number of addicts, the higher the risk of breast cancer. And that's been something that we have, you know, paid careful attention to as far as, you know, the carcinogenicity with the PAHs. And as I recall, the benzoylpyrin, it was the first classical carcinogen, it's an initiator carcinogens. And it was interesting, I think it was back in the 19th century that they discovered that the chimney sweeps were, you know, just not washing properly, and they developed cancer of the scrotum, and it was traced to benzoylpyrin exposure in the soot. People have known that these PAHs impose increased cancer risk on those who are exposed to them for a long time, and I've talked to Dr. Kevin Timoney about the existence of the PAHs at elevated levels in the environment there that is, you know, constituted by the Athabasca River. I'm quite sure it's both the sediments and the, you know, the water itself. It's very concern raising, you know, that that group of chemical carcinogens are associated with this kind of cancer and have been found in the waters of this river. Do the people of Fort Chipewyan, do they drink the water from the Athabasca River?
No. They've one of the stories that I heard consistently when I went up there initially, Don, was the history of how they, you know, respected and used the river and the lake, and they used to drink directly from the lake, and sometime in the last 10 years or so, they started to use bottled water, and especially in the last 5 years, that has become ubiquitous. But they do, for whether in the end, for good or bad, they do still subsist traditionally. So they do consume a lot of traditional foods, and of course, the lake, which the river empties into, is the source of most of that nourishment.
Yep.
So, indirectly, absolutely, there's still a close connection with it. And, of course, the lake is still, the lake and the river is still the mode of transportation. So there's ongoing exposure on a daily basis.
So what kind of wild game and fish do they eat? Is their diet, is it a lot, say, like waterfowl or fish or big game? Or what is it largely that they consume?
Yeah, there's mainly whitefish, and there's a variety of those. There's moose, there's muskrat, beaver, ducks, and grouse. Then the flora that grows abundantly on the lake's edge that's used especially as a sort of traditional form of medicine, like cattail roots, for instance, used very, very widely, and that's a partial list. The more traditional, especially the older people, would have a much more extensive list of what they use and how they use it.
It'll be interesting to know if those cattail roots have been contaminated by any pollutants. As I recall, cattails are very effective at removing pollutants from polluted water. I remember that very distinctly from some awareness that I developed in dealing with a hazardous waste site in our township down here in New York State. But if they're using that as medicine, it would be very strange that it would turn out to be a contaminated medicine, I don't know how PAHs figure in, cattail uptake.
One of the issues that interesting that came out 4 years ago was a warning from no less than industry about the potential contamination of moose meat and cattail roots with arsenic. Arsenic occurs naturally in the sort of Athabasca area, but with mining for tar sands, arsenic is released in much greater quantities, and of course it becomes more active when it's released under the current ways of mining. So industry had warned that with their latest expansion back then in 2006 that arsenic could rise to up to 453 times the upper limit of what's considered safe in moose meat and cattail roots.
Wow.
And the government's reaction immediately, the Alberta government's reaction immediately, was to denigrate this and suggest that this was a wild guess, an extrapolation, and they were going to do their own study. And their own study consisted of them asking the people of Fort Chip to provide samples of moose meat and cattail roots. After several months, the community, of course, had no faith that anything was going to come of this. There were some samples sent out to Edmonton for analysis by the Alberta provincial government. Came back to the community a few weeks later, saying that their analysis showed that arsenic varied from 17 to 33 times the upper limit of what's considered safe in moose meat and cattail roots.
Wow.
Now, that alone was, shocking.
Right.
This was supposed to reassure the community. I pointed out to these individuals from Edmonton that the industry's warning was exactly that, an extrapolation based on industry, the rate of expansion of the industry. So I asked her, do you have plans to follow this? If you're saying that this is the arsenic level right now, do you plan to follow this? And the response was, we have no budget for this. Community was enraged. Yeah, nothing has happened since, and of course the tar sands are set to triple in the next short few years.
So right now, the cattail and the moose, doesn't sound like to me that you'll be wise to be consuming them.
No,
you know,
definitely
the arsenic, it has, I'm sure, many health effects. The one that I'm familiar with is, you know, it's a initiator carcinogen, and I've been long aware of how it's involved in lung cancer causation when people drink water that's contaminated with arsenic. Oh, well, you know, it seems to be a lot of risk and harm occurring up there. So it has seemed to me, see, I started becoming knowledgeable about tar sands, you know, started studying and trying to learn about tar sands back in the spring of 2009. So it's been a year and a half or so since I've been looking into this. And the chemicals that I have encountered as far as pollutants released by tar sands that have a potential to harm as far as cancer go are the PAHs and these metals such as, say, the arsenic and cadmium and chromium and lead, I believe, was another metal that was released by tar sands exploitation and was a pollutant that increased in the environment, in the accessible part of the environment. The part that, you know, people are exposed to during the course of the activity of the tar sands operations. Is that pretty close to being correct?
Yeah, vanadium, I would add to that, and mercury. There's actually a very much more extensive list that's been compiled by Dr. David Schindler.
Okay.
Dr. Timoney is also aware of that. And the bigger issue for many of us, including Dr. Schindler and Timoney, is the effect of the synergistic effect of these heavy metals when they combine with each other and in sort of compounds that, you know, haven't really been identified and people are unaware of. What are the effects of these? Nobody knows.
Right. Yeah, I heard something about a paper. I think it was something that Dr. Timoney was like making known to me. I think he was stating that the synergistic effect of the PAH exposure and the arsenic exposure was quite a multiplication of the cancer risk that was imposed by the exposure. I think 8 times comes to mind. I'm not certain of that, but as I recall, I think it was that if one is exposed to arsenic and PAHs together, then the cancer risk is 8 times as much as if the exposures were to occur separately. Yeah, there's such a lot that we don't know, and this is such a huge part of the problem. When people are expected to prove that something is harming them, when the science just isn't there yet, and yet the harm is taking place, and in basic logic and reasonableness, it appears to be caused by a certain, you know, source. It's very difficult for people to protect themselves. And so we're kind of getting to this stage here where I'd like to ask you some questions about government involvement. You've told me some of government involvement. It sounds like it was good that the province did test those cattails and that moose meat. Certainly was an important step to be taken, but it's bad that they're not going to continue to analyze these foods and this medicine. What about the existence of public health offices to which officers are appointed, you know, people that have a responsibility? In the U.S., and I'm sure in Canada, there's this long, government has for very, very many years been looked to and held the power of being responsible for protection of public health. Our New York State Department of Health, for example, they publish a chemical advisory. It's called something about chemicals in sport, fish, and game. And they recommend that girls and women of childbearing age consume no fish from the waters of the Great Lakes or the St. Lawrence River because of the presence of dioxin and myrrhex in the bodies of these fish. And so clearly, based upon their activities and the way people perceive government, and I've seen some of the laws that relate to this, there's a role and a responsibility for government in situations where harm is taking place and a person truly doesn't have an opportunity to protect themselves on their own. It's, you know, it's a difficult matter. It's very complicated. It's costly. There's a lot of science, a lot of chemistry, a lot of analysis, a lot of, you know, gathering samples and dealing with, you know, quite a large problem. So tell me about what government public health offices exist in the province of Alberta, whether, you know, and where, you know, where these, say, like if a complaint were to come in, say if something was happening that was harming public health, where the tar sands activity is going on, who are the public health officers that are responsible for taking action that would protect the public against that harm continuing?
Well, in the area of the river, Athabasca River and the lake and Fort Chip, it's a sort of complex, multi-jurisdictional responsibility. On reserve in Fort Chip, the federal Canadian government, Health Canada, is responsible for all health issues. Off reserve, the provincial Department of Health is responsible for public health issues. But there's also, when it comes to the Athabasca River and the lake, there's also the Department, Federal Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and they have a responsibility when it comes to the health of fish, for instance. And there's also a input and responsibility for the aspects of the health of the river and the land, you know, which is provincial land, responsibility at the level of the provincial Department of the Environment. Now, the federal government's responsibility is significant and made more significant by the fact that the federal government in, I believe, 1899 signed treaties with First Nations across the country. And these treaties guarantee right to fish and to hunt and, you know, access to traditional ways and protects these rights. So protects, on paper, the health of these, you know, foods and fish and, you know, wildlife, etc., so that First Nations can continue to follow their traditional practices. And obviously that hasn't happened in this case. There's been, you know, a multitude of reports that have come out over the recent past year that indicate quite clearly that this isn't happening. So the federal government and so two departments, Department of Indian Affairs at the federal level and the Department of the Environment, are both immediately on the hook for this. This sort of dereliction of duty, followed very closely by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. So, you know, their responsibility and role in having and allowing this to happen is huge. And when you get to the public health side of it, there's the two departments, federal and provincial departments of health, Health Canada federally and the Alberta Provincial Department of Health in Edmonton, that have sort of stood by while this has happened on their watch. And when it comes down to identifying who's the most responsible party, it has been extremely difficult because of this complex, you know, division of responsibility. However, on the basis of a report that came out in February of 2009, and basically because of It appears because of media pressure, the provincial Department of Health Cancer Board, based in Edmonton, did a year-long study, which came out in February of 2009, a year-long study of cancer numbers in Fort Chip, and they confirmed a 30% higher rate of cancer and no known you know, particular cause found. So a recommendation from the Cancer Board was that a study should happen to find out why there is such a cancer burden in Fort Chip. So based on that, a committee has been meeting. I'm part of this committee. And the committee is comprised of federal and provincial health representatives, including physicians, and some bureaucrats from mainly from the provincial government, to look at the whole issue and also to look at the wider scope of the health of people in Fort Chip. So there is sort of a recognition of that complex responsibility, division of responsibility, and the need to, I guess, to be accountable and to start paying attention. And that has been the first, and that's significant. And we're at the point where we're looking at, you know, putting together something that could be a study or may, with a bit of modification, be the basis for a study of the community of Fort Chip. However, and that's the bright spot. The other issue with regard to the monitoring of the river and the environment when it comes to tar sand mining has been very problematic. The Alberta government has stated repeatedly on the record, on film, in public, you know, in many, many, many locations, that the Alberta government have world-class regulations when it comes to monitoring of the tar sands, or the oil sands, as they call them, and that they have found repeatedly no evidence of any contribution of degradation of the environment or the water from tar sand mining. And in the last 3 to 4 weeks, we've had 3 reports that have come out that have been accepted by provincial and federal governments that indicate that there's actually no monitoring at all going on when it comes to any of the pollutants from the tar sands. The Alberta government has not been doing any significant monitoring. So their basis for stating that there is no evidence of any change or any degradation, and that they have world-class regulations in place, and they're proud of what they have done, that there's no basis for stating that. There's been a gross misrepresentation of this. And the federal government have now stated that they want to get involved in this whole process and start monitoring. Now, there's been no consensus between the federal and provincial governments as to what's going to happen. This came out, the last of these 3 reports came out just before Christmas. So, you know, into the doldrums of Christmas, and, you know, nothing much happens. We've heard nothing substantial to state that this federal monitoring program is going to start.
So if someone wanted to advocate for action on those reports, they need to read the reports. How can people find these reports?
Oh, my gosh, they're online.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Say, what website would you recommend for finding these reports?
Well, the first one that came out was the Federal Environmental Commissioner, and this would be under the Auditor General of Canada.
Okay.
Her office. So the Federal Environment Commissioner slammed the federal government for its lack of action and lack of monitoring of waterways in Canada. He chose 3 representative waterways, and one of them was the Athabasca, and he did not mince his words at all.
Okay.
The next one that came out, a slightly more puzzling report that came out from the Royal Society of Canada, that talked about the lack of evidence, lack of available evidence to suggest a link between tar sand toxins and cancer, elevated cancer rates in Fort Chip. But they also stated that the data that they had reviewed, they didn't do any study of the reviewed available data, that the data was very limited, and they stated that repeatedly. So it was a little puzzling that they could categorically state there was no link between tyrosine toxin and cancer in pork chop, and they hadn't done any study of their own, and they, you know, admitted that the data available was quite limited. But nevertheless, they went on to state that there was a huge gap in information and intelligence about the tyrosines in relation to the waterways. And then back in September, Dr. Schindler and Dr. Timoney and Dr. Aaron Kelly, the community for CHIP, and a number of others, including myself, presented to the public in Edmonton a display of the types of deformed fish and the numbers of deformed fish that have been taken from Lake Athabasca. Quite horrifying to see them. Of course, the community had been aware of this for years, and the numbers increasing. This shocked the federal government at the time, and the environment minister at that time, Jim Prentice, who since resigned for unrelated reasons, suggested that the federal government should do a study of their own into this whole issue of monitoring of the river and the lake. So a six-member panel of scientists was appointed to do exactly that, and their report was the last one that came out just before Christmas, and they categorically stated that when it comes to monitoring of the Athabasca in relation to the tar sands, there was no monitoring.
So where does one find that report?
Again, online, Federal Environmental Athabasca Review, I think, is the specific reference.
Yeah, I want to read it, and I'm sure a lot of other people will want to read it.
It's very compelling reading, and you know the stature of the six scientists is you know, significant. The respect that they have in the scientific community, and the fact that nobody at a federal or provincial level even questioned their conclusions, that speaks volumes. Because every other scientists, including Dr. Schindler, Dr. Kelly, and Dr. Timoney, have been attacked for their daring to suggest that there's anything other than pristine water in the Athabasca River system and the lake.
Hmm. What a terrible situation, you know. Just worst of government, worst behaviors of government imaginable up until now, and it seems like it does sound like that finally the federal government, I'm sure because of the media attention to these problems that you discovered with the cancers in the people and the deformities in the fish, finally you guys have sparked some action on the part of federal government, and the media is kind of helping by causing them to be a little more embarrassed than they will be just amongst Canadians. And it's good to hear that your work is, you know, creating some change. Wow, this is truly, to me, in my view, my conclusion, it is that this tar sands activity and the results of it, it's like the environmental issue of probably all time. You know, it may well be that the human race, once they go through this, they might never let it get that bad again. Hopefully they would not. It certainly is just a huge, terrible environmental problem and health problem that exists right now and is now being acted upon by, you know, say yourself and Dr. Timoney and Dr. Schindler and these various government people just kind of skipping along around the edges and trying to, you know, probably do as little as they can to look okay. Wow, it's very interesting, very exciting. I find it, I was in the province of Saskatchewan in the winter of 2008-2009, you know, it's up in Prince Albert. I was down there from a place I was living up on Lake Wapawika for the north, and it was really interesting to see that at this public library that I went to in Prince Albert, there was quite a display of that talk that Andrew Nikiforuk was going to do on his tar sands book, and there was this lady from, I think she was involved with either government or industry, that was going to be, you know, the other side of the, you know, the debate, and it's very concerned that this will, you know, spill over into, well, it already is in a certain kind of way, it's already spilling over into Saskatchewan with the acid precipitation and the impact on the lakes and these various environmental damages that are being caused by that. See, the air pollution has always been the most interesting part of environmental issues for me, just because we've always had so much combustion to deal with down here in New York State and in factory smokestacks. So I wasn't as quick to focus on the water issues that you're describing to me, but I've learned to focus on them in this particular, you know, environmental catastrophe that's going on with tar sands exploitation. Let me think here for a minute. You've just been, like, overwhelming with me with all this new information, and my brain is, what else do I? I just don't want to let you go quite yet. Tell me about your hopes for the future. Do you? I was talking to Andrew Nikiforuk yesterday, and he says that the way he sees this playing out is that this volatility of the market and these concerns about, you know, gasoline spikes and diesel fuel spikes and, you know, and the brittleness of this large monster that's been created by getting our gas and oil from tar sands activity, that he sees that as these flaws in the, you know, these reasons why and these kind of these entities that exist that will eventually lead to the fall of the tar sands activity and the, maybe even, you know, bring it to an end or at least, you know, slow it down or, you know, make it less and less appealing as it goes along. But he didn't see the environmental activism as a very significant part. And I think that's because of his background. He's a business reporter. And I'm not saying anything critical of him because he's a brilliant person and I just loved talking to him and his getting his insights on these things. But from your perspective as a medical person, who's going to be, you know, will the environmentalists play a significant role? Is it going to be medical professionals like yourself? Is it scientists? You know, and it's probably going to be all of these, you know, working together. But, you know, just tell me about where you see the effort to bring an end to this awful way of getting energy for our people here in the U.S. and Canada. You know, where do you see the effort to bring this to an end shaping up? You know, how's it going to shape up? Who's going to be players? What do you know?
I have tremendous respect for Andrew. We've become very, very close friends over the last few years as a result of our sort of involvement and him from the business writing perspective and his background and you know, enormous knowledge of what's going on.
Exactly.
I can see exactly his point in, you know, in terms of the environmental groups, simply because the, I guess at the end of the day, the resources available, you know, in comparison to industry and government, the resources available to environmental and you know, health advocacy groups are minuscule by comparison. When it hurts the pocketbook, when it hurts the economy, when it hurts, you know, other industries, you know, manufacturing, for instance, has been decimated by, as a result of, and indirectly as a result of the way oil has headed, you know, when it peaked at 140 odd bucks a barrel, it coincided with a huge number of layoffs in industry in Canada, presume in the U.S. as well.
Yep.
And sort of that. Is, I think, going to probably be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of bringing people to their senses. However, I believe that 4 years ago, 5 years ago, my gosh, it's 5 years ago this month, that the media became aware of what was going on in Alberta. That was a turning point, and, you know, it's easy now looking back to see it. Because that precipitated eventually action by government under duress. It brought about the scientific community's more intense look at what's going on and resulted in, for instance, the three reports that I've mentioned being issued and now the whole world is watching what's going on. So I think, you know, the role of, you know, the economic impact and the need to be sensible about this whole industry, the effect on global warming, obviously, and Canada's role on the international stage, which has been terrible in sort of bearing its responsibility to mankind when it comes to issues like this, and the environmental effect more locally and the effect on people's health. I think there's going to be to get back to the word we used a short time ago, a synergistic effect on for the good in influencing this industry going in the right direction. And you know, when you talk to people that are at a grassroots level, Donald, especially in Fort Chip, there's a need to obviously make a change, to make a difference, to preserve what's left of the community and traditional ways and health, and to hopefully fix many of the problems that appear to be influenced by this industry.
Yep.
But also to ensure that in the process of doing this, that an industry that has served as the basis or the origin of for many, for, you know, the family incomes of bread and butter, that it isn't sort of abruptly taken away, because that would be unfortunately an economic disaster for downstream communities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, between concern at the point of impact of this industry and the agitation that's happened on the sort of provincial, national and international stage with environmental concerns, and Andrew's correct indicator of the effect of on the economy and other industries of the continued use of this resource and the way it's used, I think we're at a point where, you know, there appears to be a node or a tipping point, perhaps, that's going to bring about change.
Yep.
I know I'm being a bit long-winded about this, but
no,
I'm
good.
So
I understand. It's a complex matter, and it's difficult to put it correctly, you know, just to state it the way you believe it will turn out. Because it is partly, you know, looking into the future, and it's talking about something that's very complex and a very large thing, you know. I you know, understand totally how you're, you know, why you're speaking as you're speaking. It's fine. I have to say that in seeing this as this, you know, environmental issue of all environmental issues, that I do just find it very, very exciting. And so when I see, maybe when I see these environmental activities going on, I tend to give them, you know, more like a magnify them and make them a bigger part of this change that's hopefully coming along and it will, you know, transpire. And I'm just thinking that, you know, whether I'm overdoing this or not, it's just, still, it's powerful. There's a lot of power in this. I've talked to so many different groups. This, the one that comes to mind right at the moment, this Dustin Johnson with the Sierra Club's Prairie Chapter and the work that he had done prior to taking up that position with Sierra Club. He's a First Nations, and I cannot recall the name of the, you know, the First Nations group that he belongs to, but it's a British Columbia First Nations that it was so, I thought it was so cool the way he said they had never signed any treaties. They never made any deals with the Canadian federal government or any other government. They exist totally on their own, you know, in their own right, and they are the total nation, First Nation of that part of British Columbia. And it happens to be where Enbridge wants to build this pipeline. I believe it will come to the ocean at Kitimat. I think that was this village that he named. And he is so powerful in the way he talks about the old ways and the rightness, you know, the good rightness of the old ways and applying that to this problem. And hearing just the tone of his voice and thinking about the people he's describing and the things that they have done up until now, I'm thinking that the wedding of kind of U.S. environmental activists and these First Nations people that are so, so clear and strong about opposing this and bringing it to an end, I think that's going to become more and more powerful and important and significant in bringing the end to the tar sands. It's going to be very interesting. I'm looking forward to this next couple of decades. Like, it's going to be really very, very interesting, you know, just to see the choices that are made and the actions that are taken and where this thing goes, you know. I'll tell you, I'm thinking very seriously of moving to Saskatchewan just to be on the land where this harm of the air pollution is taking place, and also where there is this potential for, you know, starting to actually do the exploitation on that land itself. Very interested in doing that, and I probably will start spending part of my time there.
I draw your attention as well to, you talk about Saskatchewan, when the 6-member panel report came out just before Christmas. I believe the day after it came out, Saskatchewan government issued a statement saying that they're going to hold Alberta responsible for any damage that this unmonitored industry has caused.
Good.
To the northern part of their community, the northern part of their province. That was very interesting. That was like the day or 2 days, maybe 2 days after. It kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit.
Yep.
The Christmas time, but that was a very significant statement, and will be interesting to follow up with.
I'm going to follow up on that. I'm glad you mentioned that just now. That is certainly the next step for me. I'm going to follow up on this statement from the Saskatchewan government. Try to find someone who would speak to that. You know, do an interview on that particular action that's been taken by Saskatchewan, because, you know, this thing, see, like, I remember so well the Montreal Lake. It's this huge lake there in central Saskatchewan. I think it was Dustin Johnson with Sierra Club Prairie Chapter. He was saying that there's beginning to be acid precipitation impacts on the fishery in that lake. And, well, Lake Wapawika, you know, it's not as large as Montreal Lake. And I'm sure not as many First Nations people fish there. But during the winter that we were living out there on Wapawika, middle of night, you know, just right in the super 35 below Fahrenheit weather, and those awesome First Nations people, the Cree, were going out through there with their snowmobiles and going out to this far distant fishing camp where they'd park their trucks at this landing on the lake, you know, at the end of the road, and then taking off on the snow machines to go out and do this. It's just so striking to me that they would do commercial fishing through the ice in that kind of cold, you know. It's like, well. And to think that that's just being ruined by some greedy oil companies, you know, that's just not going to happen, you know. Well, it's been really cool talking to you. This interview has been, you know, grand, and it's because of who you are, you know. You being a doctor and this medical person and the integrity to push on the government to do the right thing. You know, viva to, you know, an honor to Dr. John O'Connor for, you know, all the good stuff you're doing. And good luck. Good luck with continuing to take care of those people's health, you know.
I'm just doing my job, Don.
Just doing your job is like, you know, the president is saying, I'm just doing my job. You know, it's quite a job you're doing. Thanks so much for being the person you are, you know, and bringing your particular, you know, abilities and caring and thinking into play, you know, there in Alberta.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk, Donald. And again, I am so, so grateful that, you know, you're interested in this, because, like I've said before, if it hadn't been for media interest in this, we would still be struggling. And we're struggling now, but we're struggling on the world stage. You know,
yep.
It's no longer just a very, very local provincial issue. And or even a local for chip issue, for that matter, as it had been for years and years before. So, again,
that must have been brutal. That must have been truly brutal when those poor people were up there seeing that taking place in a vacuum, pretty much, and just, you know, having, you know, pretty much not being able to figure out, or having not at least figured out at that moment in time, what to do to just deal with this evolving nightmare, you know?
Well,
that must have been very hard.
So complicated, and like they said to me in 2007 or 2008, the community said very clearly and very publicly that they had been trying for years, decades, to have their concerns aired, listened to about the changes that they'd observed in their environment and the concern about fish, etc. And they said to me, now we have a voice. And, you know, that was incredibly touching,
right,
for me to be told that, but an indictment of the authorities and what they should have been doing, what they had failed miserably to do.
Yep.
But now we're on the way.
Yep. It's just wonderful. There's something to be very thankful about, you know, here in the beginning of 2011, you know, just to look back and say that has been accomplished. This is good progress. Let's all feel some good cheer, you know, for, you know, what is, you know, this movement forward, you know. Thanks a lot, you know. It's great that you've done this work, and, you know, we look forward to, you know, hearing more about what you're doing in the future and just seeing how this all comes together for the best. It's got to be for the best of those First Nations. You know, it's their land. It's their life. If the greenhouse warming, if the climate change wasn't even, you know, involved here, this should not be happening, just for the matter of, you know, those communities that have chosen that path, and now it's being just like ruined for them, you know, and they're suffering because of having chosen that beautiful path. You know, it's just very upside down and backward and wrong, very, very wrong.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much, and let's wrap this up. Anything more you want to say to the people that listen to this radio program?
Just, you know, if you're concerned about issues, you know, just the people in Fort Chip, where you have to talk about your concerns, you have to talk to your neighbor about your concerns, and, you know, and that's just, you know, on the basis of your individual concern, you've got to do that. And the other side of it is, and, you know, the audience possibly for this program is much more urbane and sophisticated. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're all human beings, and we're all advocates for each other. We have to look out for our neighbors. It doesn't matter, because what affects your neighbor will affect you. You know, there is a butterfly effect. At the end of the day, you know, it is your responsibility and our responsibility to look out for our brother. And that's what this is all about.
Exactly. And, you know, it's truly, that's a beautiful thing. If people can live that way, they will have risen some in their existence, and this will be good for them. And I hope people will just do it, you know, just grab a hold of it and do it, you know, be very good. You certainly are a good example, and people having good examples to follow will make it easier for them to rise up like that.
Well, thanks again, Donald. Thank
you
very much.
Have a great start of 2011, Dr. O'Connor.
So far, so good. And you too.
Yep. Okay.
Thanks a million. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Don Hassig with Cancer Action Network. You have been listening to Loving the Earth, Pollution-Free Revolution. This Dr. O'Connor, he has been so good to speak with. I'm hoping that people that are listening will just feel excited about starting to be Stop Tar Sands activists. This has been a Stop Tar Sands program. Viva the Revolution.